Welcome back to episode 209 of Tallboy Radio. Now, we're hoping those Florida storms don't get in the way tonight. That said, those storms have made their way all across the Atlantic and now battering the UK, so it might be us that gets cut off. But that's better than listening to us ramble for the last 20 minutes of the podcast. Isn't that right, Dave?
Yeah, it was a bit of a last-minute stand-in from the three of us talking complete nonsense. We had somebody who's a published author who then disappeared on us, so we carried on talking about how none of us are published authors and none of us are probably good enough and none of us probably will.
So we had to get him back on. We promised you on the night when we got cut off that we would get Vic back on because we need to hear the end of that anecdote, don't we? How are you doing anyway, Vic? How's the weather over there with you?
David, Adam, thank you so much for having me on. Give my regards to Gaz. I'm doing great. Yeah, last time I was in the middle of a story, and I warned you guys before. I said, you know, we're having a heavy duty storm up here, and right in the middle of it, like, bam, my power went out for about 2 hours, which isn't bad because, you know, down here in Florida with the hurricanes and stuff, sometimes the power goes out for days, and then you know when the power comes back on, then you know you're emptying your refrigerator and your freezer, and you're throwing out meat, and all sorts of crap went bad. And it's terrible here when the power goes out in the summertime because it's just so hot and humid.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I thought before we finish off that anecdote, there was something actually that I saw in the news. So I know you're in Florida. I don't know whereabouts or how close you are to Miami. But there was like an all hands in Miami not so long ago when everybody got called to a shopping mall. And there was all kinds of speculation, even stuff like those monsters, 8-foot monster scene, which is obviously completely preposterous. Did you see any of that? Was that reported over there, I'm guessing?
I caught a little bit of it on Twitter. It's funny because from what I could see from the optics from the outside, I couldn't believe that the police presence that you saw outside the mall. I mean, it looked like, you know, a mass shooting, just the amount of law enforcement presence there. I don't know really what happened because law enforcement is really, they're kind of close to the vest of what happened. They haven't released the 911 tapes, which is unusual because in Florida we have what's called the Sunshine Law, which means everything is public record. So you can go to your local police station and, like, for argument's sake, the cops are at your neighbor's house and you ask the cop, you know, what's going on? And he says, no, don't worry about it. You can go to the local police station and pull up the report to find out what happened. So I don't think it has anything to do with aliens or outer space, but something happened down there that they're really keeping a tight lid on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think they reported on, was it teens fighting and throwing fireworks at people or something? It's like, I used to work in Runcorn and that was just an average Saturday night. And I never saw that many police officers at the time that I was there.
I'm kind of guessing that it really wasn't anything because when you think about it, take a step back. This isn't 1983. Everybody's got an iPhone.
Yeah.
So if there was something that out of control, there would be, you know, law enforcement can keep a lid on some things, but there's going to be multiple images, snapshots, or it would have gone live stream on YouTube by now. I mean, somebody would have saw something. So it probably, the call came in as one thing and the cops showed up and then it turned out to be nothing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I suspected, because like you say, you can't keep anything a secret really nowadays. You know, what with social media, everybody streams their lunch or, you know, whatever that, you know, they're doing with their cat that day.
So you know what's sad about social media? It's like, you know, we all get sucked into it. We're watching what's happening, right? But then you take a step back. I've watched videos where something horrific is happening to an old person or something, and you've got 10 people with their phones out. Not one is helping the person. Now, one person is calling the police. They're all standing there trying to figure out how they're going to make cash in on this thing on YouTube. And it's sad. You know, it's, you know, instead of helping somebody or calling the police or trying to render aid or whatever you can do, you know, as a human being, and people are more interested in getting clicks.
I think to be slightly generous to some people, they may be recording it to record the offense for the police. But I think there is an instinct to record for, you know, whether they're thinking of monetizing at that point, they're probably certainly thinking of filming it to share with their friends. But there will be some that are probably recording it because they think, well, I can't really do anything, but at least I can record it. But when there's 10, 15 people doing it, you know, you don't need everyone recording it, do you?
No. I agree. Right. I mean, one or two people, I get that. But I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, I was walking my dog and a tree came down and hit a landscaper. So I tied the dog up and I was trying, the last thing I was thinking of, let me get my phone out and videotape this guy ultimately he perished. You know, I think the tree snapped his neck, but I mean, that wasn't my instinct to grab my phone and videotape the other workers trying to, I mean, I try to help the guy, but I mean, it was too late, but it just, I wasn't from this generation to go for my phone.
Yeah. We had a motorbike at the bottom of our road. A guy come around the corner and just went absolutely flying off his motorbike. And he was in the middle of the road, his bike on. And again, I was with my two kids. So I told them to stay put. And my instinct was to run over and see if the guy's all right, not to get the phone out. So it must be a generation thing. Once you get past 50, maybe you do the right thing.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope so. I'll add another story to that. So as anybody knows, I worked in retail for 20 odd years, okay? And one of the stores that I had, we had an armed robber in it. So three guys come in, like armed with machetes and axes, and rob the place. Now, the guy who made what you would call a 911 call, or we call a 999 call, okay, we had him on CCTV when we were playing it back. And literally, he stops outside doing this on his phone. And he's on it for ages. It's like, you're dialing three numbers, dude. What's taking so long? He actually stopped to update Facebook that the store was being robbed before he called 999. It's a mad world. It is a mad world.
As my late father would say, that guy needs a kick in the hole.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. So, like we said, the weather cut us a little bit short last time, and you were sharing some of your anecdotes from your new book, Laughing in the Line of Duty. And we are joined back tonight by Stuart Willis, who's watching, and he says hello. Stuart, by the way, used to be a first responder, so he's very familiar with some of these stories. So, we were with you. And you might as well start the story all over again then, because you know what I mean? We say he's patching it together from the last episode. So it was the cop on a horse story that you were telling us. And like you say, everybody loves a cop on a horse.
Everybody loves a cop on a horse. And Stewie, thanks for tuning in. Yeah, the NYPD mounted unit, each borough, you have five boroughs in New York City, and each borough has several troops of horses, and they have their own stables. And they primarily what they do is they stay in their area, and what they do is they take the horses out a couple of times a week. They get a little bit of recreation. They write a couple of parking tickets. Mounted cops really don't do any heavy lifting unless it's a parade or a demonstration or a riot. Then those things are great for crowd control. And like I said, I've been at Times Square on New Year's Eve when you're starting to get people getting a little rowdy, and they'll bring in those mounted cops. And when those horses turn sideways, that big ass comes swinging around and it hits people. They get launched. People get thrown on their asses. So this is a story that was told to me by a good friend of mine. New York City in the 1970s was really rough. It's come full cycle. Now New York is like that now, but it was really rough on the west side of Manhattan. You had the Hell's Kitchen area, tough, gritty Irish neighborhood. And you had this gang of thugs called the Westies, and a bunch of Irish kids. What they would do is shake down bars and restaurants for protection money. They were into the unions down there. You couldn't get a job in a place unless you paid them. They were into loan sharking. They basically ran the neighborhood. And there was a bar down there. One of the bars that was not paying protection money was this old Irish pub. And the reason they weren't was you had this NYPD mounted cop on his horse, and he would stop by a couple of times a week. And he would drink in there. Now, NYPD members have always been forbidden to consume alcohol on duty, but this was the 70s. There were no cameras, and no one was going to call up on this guy because while he was there, the bar was safe. So what this guy would do is a couple of times a week, he would ride up to this bar. It had big, wide double doors. He would duck his head down. The horse would walk through the bar. They had a little beer garden out back. He'd tie up the horse to a bench or something. He'd go inside and he'd have a liquid lunch. He'd have a couple of cocktails. And sometimes the horse would crap on the floor. And that would send the drunks. They would think that was good luck. They'd go running out across the street. We used to have in New York City called OTB, or off-track betting, where you could bet on the ponies at the different racetracks from one location because they thought it was good luck that the horse took a dump inside the bar. And this was going on for a couple of years. Well, what winds up happening is one hot summer day, the cop is in there having a couple of cocktails. The horse drops dead of heat exhaustion out in the backyard, or a heart attack or whatever. So now the cop's got a major problem on his hands, because how's he going to get the horse out of the bar? If he calls, if he gets on the radio and calls in New York at 10:13, or officer needs assistance, or even if he just gets on the phone and calls his command, the first thing anyone's going to ask is, how the hell did this horse get in the back here and drop dead? And why do you smell like alcohol? So he had a major problem on his hand. Well, the bartender's brother owned a towing company. The bartender calls his brother up and tells him, get your ass over here with a tow truck and bring a tape measure. The brother shows up, comes into the bar, and the brother says, come on, come out to the back. And he shows him the horse. And the guy goes, how the hell did the horse die? He goes, we didn't have time for an autopsy. He goes, can you get him out of here? So he says, well, if the doors are wide enough, maybe. So the guy's out there with the tape measure. He's measuring the horse. He's measuring the doors. He's like, I think I can do it. So what they did was they backed the tow truck up to this bar restaurant, and they pulled the long cable through the winch. They hooked it up to the horse's bridle, and they slowly pulled the horse through the bar. And the drunks are crying, and they're hoisting whiskey because they like, I mean, the horse was like a staple of the neighborhood. Once that horse hit the sidewalk, the tow truck driver wanted no part of this shit. He knew it was a problem. He took off, right? The cop jumps on his radio and calls at 10:13, right? The cavalry shows up, including his supervisor, and then he goes into this Oscar award-winning performance of, my God, I just went in to use the bathroom. I tied the horse up to a lamppost, and he dropped it in front, right? There's a couple of drunks in the bar. They interview them. They back up the story. They swear in a stack of Bibles. That's exactly what happened. Couple of weeks later, they have a memorial service for the horse, and everybody in the neighborhood comes. They're playing bagpipes, you know, goodbye, my good friend. A month or two later, the cop shows up with another horse. They gave him a new partner, but he would never bring the horse inside the bar. What he would do is, two doors down, there was a parking garage. He would pay the guys inside. He would tie the horse up in the parking garage because he figured if the horse dropped dead in the parking garage, you could always say he just went in there to use the bathroom.
That wasn't the way I thought that story was going to end. I'm not going to lie.
The fact that all that happened and you know, nobody called the police.
You got to remember something, right? This is, we're talking the 1970s, no cell phones. No one's, unless you were a tourist in New York City, which you wouldn't be in Hell's Kitchen. No one's got a camera. And even if you had a camera, you know how long it takes to get the film developed? It was even before 24-hour photo. You had to mail it out to Ohio somewhere and wait 3 weeks for it to come back.
I forgot it was so long ago, Vic.
Right? Think about the way we lived. I mean, and I loved it. But, I mean, think about the generation, like the kids now. They have no concept to wait for things.
No. And it's funny that it goes back to how we started this episode in terms of talking about social media, and everything is immediate. And I do think that with these days, like we say, everybody films it. And I thought it when you were talking through that. If you're at a concert or something like that, the amount of people you see filming it, or even fireworks. I took my kids to a firework display this year because we have like Guy Fawkes Night on the 5th of November in this country. And my kids were absolutely loving it. You know, fireworks at that age, it's a novelty. By the time you get to 50, you get a bit tired of them after the first two minutes or so. But everybody's filming, and I was just thinking, when are you ever going to watch that back? You know, when are you going to watch fireworks on your phone? It's utterly bizarre.
Your lips to God's ears, it's so true. And I don't know if you guys, when you were kids, had access to fireworks. So New York City, fireworks have always been illegal. All right? Always, always, always. Who runs the fireworks in New York City? The mafia. So fireworks were illegal all year round. The cops really didn't care if kids were running around throwing fireworks at each other. They might confiscate a bag if you're being too obnoxious, but for the most part, nobody gave a shit. So in my neighborhood, there were certain guys that paid the mob. The mob would sell them the fireworks, and then they would pay them a kickback for selling it. So in my neighborhood, there was a mailman, and I kid you not, this is in my book, Confessions of a Catholic High School Graduate. There was a mailman that lived on a main street, like a main thoroughfare, not like a side street. And every day in the summertime, this guy would come home in his mailman outfit, and you'd see 20 boys standing in front of his house like crows, just waiting for this fucking guy, right? He'd come out and he'd go, all right, guys, just hold on a second. He'd go into the house, he'd get a beer, and right next to his house, he had this tiny garage, and he'd have a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. He'd open up the garage and like, I want bottle rockets, I want bomb pops, I want cherry bombs, right? And we'd go like pay, everything was cash. And I mean, the gate was open. I mean, if anyone drove by, he had a couple of $1,000 worth of fireworks in there. And what we would do is, I mean, this went on all summer. I mean, not that the 4th of July things picked up and the prices went up. But what we would do is we would buy lots of rockets. And then there was like this little crappy beach area in my neighborhood. And what we would do is in the summertime, we'd go down there about 6-7 o'clock before the sun went down with shovels. And we would dig trenches and drag out pieces of wood and build little forts. And once the sun went down, we'd have rocket wars with each other and, you know, shooting Roman candles at each other and firing rockets. But my brother was a madman. My brother would get his hand on those M80s or cherry bombs and throw it in your foxhole. Like, you could blow your arm off with those things. So we used to come home with like missing chunks of hair and burn marks on my arm. And my mother's like, what the hell are you guys doing? Nothing. Someone shot fireworks at me. But we were like up to our necks in it. That was like a big thing in my neighborhood.
That's mad.
That sounds incredibly dangerous. Surely somebody at some point must have got hurt and ended up in hospital.
Oh, yeah. In my neighborhood, every now and then someone was like, Nicky Fingers was missing a finger. You know, it was like, yeah, absolutely. Guys got burned and stuff. But I'll tell you how it comes full circle. So now, 20 years later, I'm an NYPD detective. And every summer, probably mid-June, the NYPD gets on this big kick that's try to stop fireworks from coming into the city. So fireworks are legal in different states, but not New York City. So what they would do is even though I worked in auto theft, they took guys that worked in organized crime, and they would send us in teams of 2 and 3 cars to different states. So Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, I think Maryland. And what we would do is we would sit across the street from fireworks warehouses in different states. And we would watch. And if a car pulled up and loaded their car with a lot of fireworks, we would run the plate. The plate came back to the 5 boroughs of New York City or Long Island, meaning they would have to cut through New York City. We'd follow them back into the city and then arrest them when they came into city lines. Now, we weren't locking a guy up that got a brown paper bag with sparklers and rockets for his kid. We were locking up the guy that showed up with a minivan that they took all the seats out and they put 2 pallets of firewood because he's going out to sell them again. I felt so hypocritical doing it, but it was for overtime. And one time we're sitting in this little shitty motel parking lot across the street from this fireworks place in Pennsylvania. And the owner of the fireworks place figures out what we're doing. So he comes into the parking lot. He goes, get the fuck out of here. He goes, you guys in New York. He goes, you don't belong in Pennsylvania. I go, do you own the motel? And he goes, well, I know the guy. I says, well, when the guy from the motel tells me to get lost, I'll get lost. And you fuck off, right? So then he's on his cell phone trying to get in touch with the owner of the motel to tell us to move, right? While he's doing that, I see these 2 steroid guys loading a ton of fireworks into their car. And just before he could get the owner on the phone, he goes, hey, I got it. He hands me the phone, and it's the owner telling me to get out of the lot. But the car with the steroid guys and the fireworks are driving off. So I took the phone, I threw it back at him, and you know, bounced off his chest. And we followed the 2 steroid guys into the city. And we pulled them over by Yankee Stadium, and we arrested them.
No way. What was it like on Stakeout, though, dude? I mean, we've all seen the movies, and I think, you know, probably myself and Dave's idea of what, you know, it meant to be an NYPD is less sort of documentarial, but more something like what we'd see in the A-Team or something like that. that was a little bit more.
Yeah, we did surveillance. Yeah, but there's different types of surveillance. So I sat on a lot of stolen cars. So what would happen is I'd find a stolen car. I run the plate and it comes back stolen a day or two and the car is in nice shape. All right, it's parked somewhere. It's cooling off. So it's an art to follow somebody and it's an art to sit on a stolen car. So if I'm watching a stolen car and I want to arrest the driver, depending on the neighborhood, right? If it's a rough neighborhood, if you get too close to it, you're going to burn it. When I mean burn it, the street urchins are going to see you and they all know that's Robbie's car. He just stole that yesterday. Hey, Robbie, there's a couple of DTs or detectives up the block. Robbie's never getting into that car. You don't want to park too far away because if something, a UPS truck or a bus comes by or the sun starts going down and the sun is in your eyes, that thing will move. That's happened too. We're sitting on something and just something for that split second just takes your attention off it and it's gone. So there's an art. You don't want to get too close, but you don't want to stay too far away. What we would do with stolen cars sometimes, we would wait, you know, a day. Like, say I'm sitting on a stolen car all day and it doesn't move, right? I come back the next day, it's still there. What I would do is I'd come back the next morning really early before the street was moving around with people. You get like a dozen eggs and you throw them all over the car. And that usually will prompt someone to say, oh, shit, it's going to stand out. Let me take it to a car wash and let me hose it off. And then you grab them. You know what I mean? Or you give it a flat tire that they got to move it now. The guy's going to take his time changing the tire. So they used to play their games. We used to play our games. As far as following somebody, kind of the same rules apply. And it depends on how many guys you're following somebody with, right? If you got a couple of cars, you can do parallels where one guy's following behind, one guy's kind of paralleling from another street away, and you can switch off. Because if the guy keeps seeing a white van, he knows it's the cops. So you kind of want to change off every now and then. But it also depends on the guys you're working with. Some guys can fucking drive and some guys can't drive. You know, some guys are like, we did a couple of cases with the New York State Police and they're used to driving 100 miles an hour on the highway. They'd be up the guy's ass and the guy knew he was being followed. So it is fun, stakeouts as you call it, or surveillance, but like it can be boring. Like sometimes, and if you're working with a guy that's not your partner, say your partner bangs in and he's sick or something, and you're working with like the village idiot, it can be very frustrating if the guy's not into it. You know, he's reading a book. You know what I mean? You want to take your eyes off it. You're like, hey, put the fucking book down. And could you do this? I got to use the bathroom, you know, and then you come back from the bathroom and the car is gone. So there's a lot of that.
When you said a few minutes ago that you mentioned about when you cross the state lines parked in a motel and the guy says he's going to get the owners to shift you. So, I mean, you see it in the movies where criminals, they get over the state line so that they can't be arrested. I mean, is that what it's like? Your jurisdiction ends?
No. No, like if we chase somebody into another state or another, just if it's just like a couple of miles in or something, yeah, they don't want you going into another jurisdiction and pulling people out of bed without letting the local police know. But that can get hairy too. So like I was a bit player in this case. Like I was like a tambourine player in this band. And there were these Nigerians that were shipping cars out of the country in Queens. And it was a bunch of them. So they needed multiple teams for my office. So basically, I just got handed the night before a folder with a couple of arrest warrants with a couple of guys' photos and an address. So they said, all right, go out to this town in New Jersey and just pick these guys up first thing in the morning. I said, all right. So I know nothing about this area. So we were supposed to like knock on these guys' doors and drag them out of bed at like 6 a.m. So what my sergeant and I, it was me, my sergeant, my lieutenant, and another couple of detectives. We're wearing our windbreakers. Like we're in plain jeans and sneakers, but wearing windbreakers, right? Blue windbreakers that say NYPD on it. So we go to this little police department in New Jersey about 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. And what we were going to do is just stop at the front desk and show them our credentials and say, listen, from the NYPD's auto crime division, we got a couple of guys that live at this address. Could you lend us a police cruiser with two of your guys to come with us just in case we get into a chase or, God forbid, a shootout? Because our radio is not going to work on their frequency, you know, and if people see, you know, they don't think it's a home invasion if they see uniformed cops from that town. Right. So there's this old time sergeant at the desk. We come walking into his station house, 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, and the guy looked like he was going to have a stroke. And I went into what I just explained to you guys. I'm here. Could you? And he goes, FBI? And we're all looking at each other. We go, no, New York City Police Department Auto Crime Division. And I went, he goes, so you're not here for any of my guys? And I go, so now all of a sudden I'm like, what the fuck is going on in this police department? They're afraid that the FBI is here. You know what I mean? Like, so he goes, all right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Then all of a sudden he tries to play. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Yeah. Let me. Gets on the radio. He calls in a sector car. These two cops came in. I kid you not. Like they were like perps in uniform. They got gold, like guy's got a gold bracelet. Another cop's got a gold tooth. And I'm like, all right, I understand now why he thought we were the FBI. And we went with these, and I was kind of afraid these guys were going to get on the phone and call our perps and say, the NYPD's here to arrest you. But so they want you to kind of check in with another police agency if you're going to go into another jurisdiction.
So it's a bit of respect, a bit of manners. But
absolutely.
But you can arrest anybody anywhere ultimately.
No, out of state. So like if you just chase them in, it's called hot pursuit. If you just chase them in, then you can bring them back. But if, you know, you got an arrest warrant or something, they want you to go to their magistrate from that state.
Okay. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. I'm disappointed to find out that the Cannonball Run is a lie when they're chasing that Lamborghini and they say, oh, we're going to have to give up chase because we're going to go across state lines.
All right.
I'm good. Burt Reynolds has lied to me personally.
You know, the Cannonball Run is a ripoff. There's a better movie than the Cannonball Run. It's the same thing. It was called the Gumball Rally.
Yeah.
And you saw it?
Yeah, I've seen it. Yeah.
My parents took me to see that when I was a little boy. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. I've always been a big fan of Burt Reynolds. So, you know, for me, Cannonball Run wins out. 2, not so bad. 3, absolutely appalling. But that's another matter. That's one for another podcast.
My mother loved Burt Reynolds. And when I was a kid, I don't know if you guys, you guys would remember this. In the late 70s, early 80s, there was a magazine called Playgirl, which was kind of like on Playboy. So Burt Reynolds was the first man to pose nude in the United States in a magazine. So I'm like 13 years old, right? I come home one day from school and you got my mother, my aunt, my grandmother huddled around something at the table, right? And they didn't hear me come in. And I walk in and it's like, oh, Vic, what are you doing here? And like that thing got closed and put in a drawer, right? I'm like, well, what's it? I kind of knew what was going on, right? So like I brought that up decades later when my mom was still around and she was like, I didn't look. Let me tell you something. That was your aunt and your grandmother. I didn't look. And I was like, but she kept protesting so much that I knew. And I saw them. They were all standing around it. Like decades later, she's trying to change history. Like, but she had a thing for Burt Reynolds, just like she had a thing for Ian McShane or Lovejoy.
Yes, she liked hair suit men, clearly.
Well-groomed men, yeah.
Yeah, short, that's not groomed men. Yeah, that is not why I'm a fan of Burt Reynolds, by the way. I just thought he was a cool dude. Yeah, that's crazy. So when we're talking about the fictional side of things, though, for movies like Police Academy, did you guys get a little bit of flack on the streets when those movies were coming out? You know, people cracking wise.
Yeah, but those movies, I got hired in 87. I think the Police Academy movies started coming out early, like 83, 84. It's funny you should say that because the other night one of them was on. Not the first one, like, but yeah, people would bring it up, but like, that was LAPD. You know what I mean? Their Police Academy and their rules and regulations and everything, that it was total different. Yeah, but we used to hear it, but I mean, it really didn't affect us.
No. What about stuff like Frank Drebin and Police Squad?
Oh, I love that. That, you know, people forget, like, before the movies came out, that was a short-lived television series in the early 80s, Police Squad. And, like, we thought that was the funniest thing. Like, I was a sophomore or junior in high school. We loved those. That Leslie Nielsen was funny.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love Police. I think they only made something like 12 episodes of that. And then obviously they went on and did 3 movies or something like that. But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely fantastic. Yeah, that's interesting. So you've just released your 7th book, which we've named this episode After Laughing in the Line of Duty. When can we expect book number 8?
Funny you should say that. As of last night, I'm about 70 pages into my next book. I'll probably have it out probably late summer. I don't have a title for it yet, but that's always the thing I struggle about.
Yeah. You don't hang around, do you?
No, Rolling Stone gathers no moss.
How many more do you think you've got in you, Vic, on the same theme?
I think what it boils down to when it's not fun anymore, or I think that I'm really stretching it with the stories, the content just isn't there, then I'll write about something else. You know, it's funny, like I've written 7 books, 5 of which are about the New York City Police Department. And I mean, I think my favorite is Confessions of a Catholic High School Graduate, but I knew it would not sell as much as the NYPD ones. You know, it's almost like your favorite musician and you go to see their concert and they're not playing the hits. They're playing like the Beatles play like some of their songs. You know, they're like, why did I pay money to hear this shit? It's like, that wasn't my favorite album, but that's what they like playing. You know what I mean? So it's like, because my brother was begging me to write that Confessions of a Catholic High School Graduate, because it's about growing up in the Bronx and us being hooligans in the 70s and 80s. But I told him, I go, it's not going to sell like the other ones, because NYPD, New York City Police Department, that's what gets people's attention. That's what people want to hear about.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, we have a question. We have a question from a viewer who asks, did you ever consider going into the FBI? And if so, why didn't you?
Vic, before you answer this, Vic, this is from my daughter.
Oh, hi, Alice. I did not. I always wanted to be a New York City police detective because I grew up in New York City. I didn't want to travel. I was enamored with the NYPD. I have done joint cases with the FBI. Let's see, who else? State Department, DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, ATF, did a couple of things with them. It just never appealed to me because you got to think about it. When you work for the FBI, they can send you anywhere in the country to work. So, you know, chances are you might want, would I wind up in New York? Probably, but I could also be on an Indian reservation in South Dakota, you know, so investigating check fraud. So for me, I went with what I know. Although in the early 90s, I toyed with the idea of becoming a policeman down in Florida, and I actually started the process, but then I got picked up by the narcotics division. I says, oh, this is going to be fun. So I put that to bed.
Yeah, fair play. And once you retired, then on that theme, did it ever cross your mind, you know, in a kind of going back to the old TV series of the 70s and 80s, in a kind of Jim Rockford and the Rockford Files kind of way, to be a PI at all?
I have thought about that, but it's very regulated down here in Florida. You have to get a license. First, you have to work for somebody that has a license. And a lot of it is matrimonial, you know, cheating spouses, a lot of workman's comp. So some guy says, I can't walk because I got into a fender bender. And then you get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and you catch him on his roof putting up new shingles. That just didn't appeal to me. When I did retire, I did get my certification and I became a policeman down here in Florida for about 8 months. And that was like being on a bad episode of Reno 911. I think I told you that in the last podcast. They wanted me to wrestle alligators. I spent an entire day learning how to wrestle a gator. And I was like, can't we just shoot these fucking things? And they're like, nope. Every cop gets duct tape. You're supposed to like sneak up behind him. And it's like, I'm not Steve Irwin. I'm not doing that crap. Plus down here in Florida, they're very big with the taser. Like in New York, the only person that carried a taser was a supervisor. Down here in Florida, they give them out like candy. And part of your training is you get tased. And I got to tell you, I did not like it. That thing, it's like having a heart attack. So what they do is they don't shoot you with the hooks. What they do is you stand there and they tape one lead to your armpit and the other one to your crotch. And then they get two people to stand in back of you. And then they give you a 3-second ride. And I could see how you could fight through that if you were really motivated and out of your mind. But it's like this pulsating thing. And you can hear the electricity coming through your body. It almost sounds like you're being electrocuted. And I was like, just throw yourself on the floor and get this over with. Because I was fighting it at first. And I'm like, just throw yourself on the floor. It wasn't that bad. But like another part of the training was they put they spray you with like pepper spray. And they also put like this pepper spray foam under your eyes. And when it activates, I mean, it hurts, it burns. And you've got to do a series of tests. You got to handcuff somebody. You got to order somebody to the ground with a dummy gun. You got to hit something with your nightstick. There's all like, you got to do like an obstacle course while you've got pepper spray all over you, right? And some people have panic attacks and lose their mind. And it was funny. So I went through it. I washed it all off. And then later that day, I went home and I'm raking leaves in my yard and I start to sweat. It activated again. And I was rolling around in my yard with like a rake and my neighbors like, they thought I was having a seizure. I'm like, no, it's fucking pepper spray. Just help me into the house. And I had to go through the whole thing of getting that out of my eyes again.
Do you ever think that they actually didn't want you to join?
What, say again?
Do you ever think that they just didn't want you to join the police force in Florida?
No. They paid. It was a good little police department, but it was, you know, for me to be a detective working organized crime and then go back on the road with the domestic violence and the drunk driving. And here I am in my early 40s. I'm on midnights drinking 8 cups of coffee to stay awake. You know, it being on the road as a patrolman is a young man's game. It really is. Plus, I didn't know where I was. You could drop me off in the Bronx blindfolded and I'll find my way out. I'm in Florida. Like, you know, you're chasing somebody. All of a sudden now my navigation skills are shot. I don't know north, south, east, west. You know, it's different. I don't, you know what I mean? It's not second nature to me.
You never know when you're going to stumble into an alligator, I suppose.
Or a panther.
Yeah, you got the duct tape, though. I don't know if that works so well on panthers. So we've got another question as well. And Stuart asked a question on a similar theme. Has it ever crossed your mind to be a bounty hunter?
I think Stuart wants to be the beneficiary on a life insurance policy. No, absolutely not. Listen, bounty hunters, that's a real gray area because those guys are allowed technically to break into houses and stuff if they know for a fact that the guy's in the house. I mean, as a cop, when you're going into someone's house for anything, domestic violence, any type of call, it's like going into a funhouse. They know where everything is. You don't. You know, if they got something stashed or if you're fighting with them and the guy goes, oh, I know I got a hammer behind this drawer over here and gives you a shot in the head. I mean, no, I never wanted to be a bounty hunter. There's not a really lot of bang for your buck. I mean, it's a lot of excitement, but low pay and you get yourself killed. There's easier ways to make money.
So was there another career that you did seriously consider that was nothing to do with these dangerous police-related activities, like a landscape gardener or something?
I like to garden, believe it or not, but I don't think I could make a career out of it. No, the writing. It's that was the thing for me. I was painting furniture for a while, and that was enjoyable, but then that became a bit much. What I like about the writing is I'm my own boss. I write as much as I want. I write as little as I want. I've figured out the self-publishing process to a degree. I've figured out the marketing. So I kind of, and I'm always learning. I mean, there's always tricks to this, but I enjoy this the most.
When you dropped off 2 weeks ago, which I was worried, by the way, Vic, because you said before, if I disappear, it's either a power cut or a tornado's ripped the roof off. Now we really didn't know which it was. So until you got hold of Adam, but then we carried on talking about how we're all aspiring authors, et cetera, et cetera. So it's great to have somebody on the ears. And one of the questions that we were sort of musing was, how do you approach it? And do you just write as and when, or are you quite diligent? And you say, right, I'm going to write for an hour and I'm going to write X number of words. I'm going to do that every day. What's your sort of process in that?
I've jumped around and it's an ever evolving process. Right now where we are, I make it a point to write at least 500 words a day or 2 pages. Okay, so 250 words is a page for a book. So what I try to do is, and it's funny, my mind works differently at different points of the day. I feel I'm better at editing in the morning for whatever reason, and I think I'm more creative in the afternoon or evening. So what I try to do is I set my mind as a bare minimum of 2 pages a day. Sometimes it goes more than that. It goes 4 or 5 pages and sometimes 175. But if you really want to take writing seriously, and I don't even think I'm taking it seriously, but the more, it's like anything else, the more you practice with the piano, the better you're going to be a piano player. So the more you write, the more it's in your head, the more the ideas flow. I mean, for new writers out there, always have several notepads, have one in your car, have one in your bedroom, have one where you spend most of your day. You're going to come up with an idea. You're going to forget it. Just jot it down. And just the more you work at it, the better you're going to get at it.
That's good advice, Dave. You going to take any of that on board?
Absolutely not. No.
are you into writing now? Or?
Well, when you dropped off, what Gaz reminded us is that a long, long time ago, and it must be nearly 30 years, I signed up for a sort of distance learning writing course. And it was quite expensive. I think it was something like 600 quid, but this was about 300 years ago. So it was a lot of money. But I did it because it had a lifetime, you know, there was no end date. You could keep this course going until you completed it. So I thought, well, at some point in the future, I know I will. And I did a bit, but then life took over and I've never actually gone back to it. But I definitely will. And every time I move house, even though I've not contacted him for like 10 years, I'll email them and say, just let you know, can you just remind me what module I'm on? And this is my new address. And they come back and they tell me and it's updated. So I'm on the database. So I know I'm still good for my money, but I do need to just find the time and effort. And I think maybe in a few more years' time, that opportunity will come.
I'm of the opinion no one can make you a better writer. I think it's one of those things for me. I think it's one of those things, like I said, the more you do it, you know, and then what I do is I take a step back sometimes and I'll grab one of my first books and I'll just look through it. And I've seen, to me, I can tell how I've changed as a writer, how I phrase things differently. Don't be over dependent on AI, because I see that now with writers a lot. The only thing I use AI for is before I send my book to an editor to get cleaned up, if there's problems with the book or something, or I know that something's going and I can't figure it out myself, I'll cave and I'll put a page or two through AI. But don't become because I can see that happening with writers just being dependent on that.
Interesting. Now, one of the things we discussed as well, like I've started writing a book about 12 months ago, maybe a little bit longer ago. So, you know, I've shared the story a couple of times on the podcast. My family is from America. They didn't really know I existed due to like the break, you know, in World War II, when my granddad, who's American, moved back to the States. He never really said that he had a family over here. So they never even knew my dad existed and that me and my brother existed. I used ancestry.com to track them down. And I got in touch with my cousin who's now living in San Antonio in Texas. And he's a police officer as well and has been a bounty hunter in the past as well, funnily enough. So maybe we'll get him on to tell those stories.
Cool.
But yeah. And I started writing the story of that and the journey I took because, you know, although there is sort of a World War II generation out there that is diminishing, I was fortunate enough to have that conversation with my nan before she passed away. And I do think that some of the things I learned on that journey could be useful for other people who are tracking down their family tree, because the bits and bobs that I had, the little bits of information that had been passed to me, were all wrong. You know, I thought that he was from Pittsburgh. He wasn't. He was from Oklahoma. I thought his name was Leonard Lennison. It wasn't. It was Leonard Barnett. So the bits I'd done before were completely fruitless. So now to have that information, I still have the notes, and I will get it done one day, but I have paused for about 12 months because, as I said to these guys, I think it's a story that's worth telling. But when I was doing it, it was almost like a pamphlet. It's, you know, I think it's a bigger story than that. How do you add, because we can see it from yourself and your general character. You're very, very good. You're very loquacious. You're very good at talking and sharing that. What would be your tip for me to try and flesh out those bits and bobs where I'm just largely probably just sharing facts?
Well, how many words do you have?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, because literally I haven't touched it in about 12, 14 months. I would say I had maybe a couple of thousand. I'm about halfway through the story, and I need to pad it out a lot more than that.
What I do is one of the last things I do before I send it to an editor is I go to a quiet, and it's going to take you days. Go to a quiet space and read it out loud like a play. Because you're reading something a million times doesn't mean it sounds right. It sounds right to you, but if you read it out loud, your mind goes, wait a minute. No one's going to know what the fuck I'm talking about. This makes total sense to me. It's not going to make any sense to Dave. So read it like a play. And I don't mean putting on accents and stuff, but just read it out loud. And it'll put you in the mindset of someone else listening to your work.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, you know, and you can read it out to me. And I guess the process that will happen is if there's a person there, is I'll go, but what about that? And where did that come from? And what are you talking about? What town are you in now? And where was that born? And who was he living with? And what was the house like? And all of a sudden you're going, oh yeah, those are all the bits I haven't written down.
Exactly. Right. Perfect. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah. That would be really useful to share it with somebody who doesn't know the story. You would have those questions to ask so that when I put it down into a book, they could then share it. Because the one person I tend to bounce it off, obviously, is my cousin Bo. And you know, he knows the story because I stuck it all in that original letter when I sent it out to him. And, you know, we've talked about it over many, many beers since.
No worries, Ad. We'll get some time.
I'll tell you what, that that's a good idea for a book. I'm not just telling you that because there are a lot of people that have toyed with the idea of people that have been adopted or people like yourself, where the story is kind of hazy on where your people come from. And you could, I mean, you could market it two ways, because it's an interesting story and it could also be a roadmap for people that want to go on this journey and find out where their relatives came from.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of that story, because the path that Mo wanted to take the story down, and I do think it'd be nice to have, is that once we're gone, we've got that story to share as to how, you know, we rediscovered that link. And then for me, my idea behind it was, there's going to be other people out there. You know, I'm willing to bet there's a vast amount of people in a very, very similar situation to me post-World War II, and probably post-other wars as well, where these things have happened. And it's, you know, it was a great way to maybe share that and hopefully help some people to rediscover some of those journeys for themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And the more when you write a book, try to think of it too. I mean, yeah, you want to get your message out, but you also got to look at it. I mean, I want to sell this thing. I want to make a little bit of money with this thing. I don't want to write this book, put it on Amazon, I get one review and it dies on the vine. Right? You want it to get traction. You want people to talk about it. You want people to read it. So when you're writing it, you got to keep your audience involved, as far as, and the more people it touches, the more people that are going to buy it. So, you know what I mean? Like, there's a million and one self-help books, right? Someone's looking for self-help with diet. Your book is different. So try to, like I said, your journey, and then try to work in, like, I did this, you can do this too. You know what I mean? It can go two or three prongs.
Yeah. Remember the Ian Livingstone, like, role-playing books, where you'd read a couple of chapters and then it would say, right, do you want to take the left door or the right door? Or do you want to, you know, climb the rope or something like that? Maybe you could do it like that, Ab. So your actual investigation and your journey could be like a role-playing book where, you know, well, does Adam follow up this lead, or do I go and visit this person that says they're related, or this person? And if you pick the right path, you end up connecting all the information.
I think I'll follow Vic's advice.
Shocking. I don't know why.
So then, taking it back to your podcast then, Vic, you know, we talked a little bit about the stuff that you've done and the people you've had on. What have you got in the future planned?
I think I was telling you, I have, hopefully, if I could set a date, the guy that was actually, he went undercover and bought guns from and was actually able to capture the Iceman, Richard Kuklinski, who was a serial killer in New Jersey. Hey, do you know what I'm talking about?
The name rings a bell, yeah. The name does ring a bell.
So like the late 70s, early 80s, there was this guy, Richard Kuklinski. And, you know, on the surface, mild-mannered guy, lived in the suburbs in New Jersey, wife, three kids, a dog. But he was a player. He was back then pornography was illegal in New York. He was instrumental in making those films, but he was anything for a buck kind of guy. He ran a gang. He didn't do it, but he ran a gang of guys that were doing commercial burglaries, stealing cars. And then what he would do is he was the fence. He would sell it to different people. And whenever he thought someone was going to flip or get in the way, they had to go. And what he would do is he would kill you. And then, you know, especially if he knew you, he knew the cops would be like, well, the last person he saw was Vic Ferrari. So who are the cops going to come to? Vic Ferrari, want to question you. What he would do is, after he killed some of these people, he would put them in a commercial meat freezer and he'd freeze them for a year or two. Then he would take them out, thaw them out, and dump them in another jurisdiction. Then the cops would find this guy who's been missing for 2 years and it looks like he's only been dead for 2 days. So how could Richard have killed him if he turns up in New Jersey? But the way that it unraveled was, when they were doing one of the autopsies, the body hadn't thawed 100% inside. So when the forensic pathologist was doing the autopsy, they found ice crystals in a couple of the victims and said, no, wait a minute, this guy had to have been preserved somewhere. And that's where it began to unravel. And then one of the places this guy Kuklinski was selling stolen stuff from was this like little den of iniquity they used to call the store, somewhere up in North Jersey. And the guy that ran the place flipped, and what the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms did was they put this undercover agent in there, and he eventually rubbed elbows with this guy, gained his trust, and this guy Kuklinski was selling him guns with silencers, and this guy supposedly could provide him with cyanide because he was going to poison a couple of people. And he had poisoned a couple of people with cyanide, and he was explaining to this ATF agent how they go quickly. It looks like a heart attack. It's very difficult to turn up in an autopsy and toxicology unless you're really looking for it. So eventually they caught this guy, Kuklinski. I think he was convicted of 4 or 5 murders. He goes to jail for the rest of his life, and HBO does a series of films. They go and interview him. First, it was called the Iceman Tapes, where you just had an investigative journalist interviewing him, right? Then a couple of years later, they brought on like a Silence of the Lambs kind of guy, a forensic guy to interview him, what went wrong, his personality type. But the thing with Kuklinski is the more attention he got, the more the stories. He was a big bullshit artist. Then all of a sudden it went from 5 people to 10 people. Then he killed 200 people. And then he was involved. He's telling people he killed Jimmy Hoffa and all this bullshit. So, it just got out of control. But he was a killer. And anyway, the guy that helped capture him, I'm hopefully going to have him on my podcast soon.
I thought you were going to say, and Kuklinski's on your podcast.
No, he died. You want to laugh? He was in this really shitty prison in New Jersey. It's called Trenton State. Trenton is not a nice place. It's a dingy city. Sorry, Trenton, but you know what I'm talking about. And I had to go to their state offices. This was in 2005 or 2006. I had to meet with their Department of Motor Vehicle Investigators. And the day I went out there, and I was making a joke about Kuklinski because the prison was right there, and one of the detectives goes, "He just died today," and he handed me the paper. So, rest in peace, Richard Kuklinski.
Wow. Yeah, that name does ring a bell. Do you watch a lot of true crime stuff? Because, Netflix is filled with that kind of stuff. And, we get a lot of it on Sky over here. Do you watch a lot of kind of true crime?
I do. I get a kick out of it. I won't watch television shows or, like fictional things, but I do. I watch like The First 48, if you guys ever watched that. Yeah, I do watch a lot of the Netflix specials. Actually, Netflix did a really good one. There was a serial killer in New York and New Jersey. His name is Richard Cottingham. And what he used to do is in the 70s, early 80s, Times Square in Manhattan was all sex shops and prostitution and drugs. This guy worked around there, and what he would do is he would befriend prostitutes, get them into a hotel room, kill and dismember them. And he was getting away with it for years. And eventually he got caught. And my old partner, who was a homicide detective for many years, after he retired, somehow Netflix got in touch with him. So I'm half asleep on the couch one night, and I'm hearing the narrator, and I'm going, wait a minute. That's Malcolm. That's my old partner. So then I called him. I'm like, how the fuck? He goes, they reached out to me to narrate it. He wasn't involved in that case, but with his experience, and it's vast because he was in homicide for like 17, 18 years, if not more. They wanted a guy that could speak that language. And now he's doing interviews and stuff, and I'm so happy for him because he's a great guy.
I mean, Alice really likes a true crime as well, but unfortunately, Vic, she also really likes Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh, killing me.
Hopefully you're still watching, Alice. Did you see that? Did you see that? Get off Netflix.
Yeah. I watched that one, actually. I think we chatted. I can't remember if it was on the podcast or after the podcast the last time you were on, and you told us about that, and I went and watched that afterwards. It is a very, very interesting documentary on Netflix, and I was listening out just to hear what your partner had to say there. But that's phenomenal. No one ever reached. I still think there's a trick being missed here, that these books need to be made into a TV series or something. No one's ever reached out to you, or have you ever tried reaching out to a TV series studio and selling it to them?
I'm a C-lister right now. I'm trying to break in as a B-lister. And that's the plan. I mean, I'm hoping someone in Hollywood reads one of my books and says, Jesus, this guy's got a lot of funny stories and a lot of, I've got dark stories in my books too. And someone reaches out to me and wants to option one of my books or wants me, to co-create a show or an investigative series or something. And it's happening more and more because there was that, who's fascinating? That guy, Paul Holes. He was an investigator with one of the counties in California. He actually caught the Golden State Killer through DNA from decades. This guy was actually a disgraced cop who had been fired from a small police department, but he was a serial killer. And he had gotten away with it for decades. And then through DNA, you know, someone submits their DNA to Ancestry.com and wants to know where they came from. And they say, now the police can access those databases. And then they'll reach out to you and say, do you have any cousins in the San Antonio area or in Texas? Like, yeah, I do. And that's actually how they caught this guy. And then once they figure out who you may be, they're going to follow you around. And once you toss a soda into a garbage can, or like that serial killer in Long Island that just caught, he was tossing a slice of pizza in a garbage can. They take it, they go through the DNA, and then that's how they're able to provide a match.
Wow. You know, we always thought, when, because obviously my cousin Bo and I, we did a DNA test just to be sure that I found the right person. You know, the worst thing, I basically could have catfished the guy, you know what I mean? But no, it was the right person. But so it was his brother, Jack, who had said to him, you know, you guys, you know, I'm pretty sure the story is correct, but you need to do a DNA test. So Bo, you know, he went and spat into the tube, and I did the same sort of thing. We sent it off to them. And then afterwards, after we've done it, he comes out with his stories. Yeah, a pal of mine did it, you know, because he wanted to find out a little bit about where he came from. Turned out he'd had a one-night stand 25 years beforehand, and he had a kid from it, and his wife was absolutely livid. It's like, why are you telling him this story now? You should have been starting with that story when you suggested that we did this.
Man, I didn't even think of that.
No, man, yeah. This is the thing. That whole Ancestry.com, it can open a kettle of worms, I imagine.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
It is. So, Dave, we're coming up to around about the hour mark. Have you got any final questions for our guest?
On the theme of books and authoring, you said when you run out of, run out of stories from your working life, what do you think you do? You think you'll go to a fiction novel?
I don't know if I'm creative enough to write fiction. I just don't know if I can do that, because all my stories, they've happened in one way or another. Sometimes do I got to tie a knot and bring a character in from somewhere else, another guy that I knew who would be perfect in this story? Yeah, I do that all the time, or change the dates or locations. But just to write pure fiction, I don't know if I could do it. No. I mean, maybe I could. It's a good question. I haven't really thought of it.
Yeah, well, you know, everything you say about writing down all these ideas that pop into your head, and, you know, if you're, you know, artistic license in your book, that is fiction to an extent. You know, you're only, you know, around your core story, but that's fiction. You're just extending that out, aren't you, for a bigger story?
Yeah, but to write a book totally of fiction, now you've got to be more disciplined. Now there's got to be a beginning, a middle, an end. You know what I mean? Whereas my books, they're just short stories. You know what I mean? My books are just a series of short stories of things that have happened along my way in the New York City Police Department or to other people. But to have like a whole plot, you know what I mean? And go 200 pages and be disciplined and to keep the author engaged, the readers engaged, I don't know if I could pull that off.
You might try one day, Vic.
I might. Oh, and to answer Stuart's question, he had a question about, have I ever rubbed elbows? I have. There's an entire, there we go, this doing again. There's a chapter in one of my books, I think it's NYPD Law and Disorder, it's called Rubbing Elbows. And it is all a lot of the famous people that I've bumped into along my way. Brad Garrett from Everybody Loves Raymond, great guy, tall too. John Lovitz from Saturday Night Live, great guy, funny. Columbo, the guy that played Columbo, Peter Falk, he was a little squirrely. He saw us pointing at him at the St. Patrick's Day parade, and he did not want to be recognized. And when he started crossing the street, I approached him, and he tried to do the duck, and I got him in an arm bar, and I pulled him in. I go, Mr. Falk, we're big fans. And he pretended like he wasn't Peter Falk. And then finally he admitted it, and then we got to talk to him for a couple of minutes. Kevin Bacon I got to meet, nice guy. Julianne Moore, beautiful woman, very nice. Sally Field I met at the U.S. Open. Alec Baldwin I met. Who else? Tons of Jesse Jackson I met. You know, when you work in New York City, if you're just driving around Manhattan, keep your head on a swivel, because chances are you will recognize somebody. And then there were other times I was working special events where you knew they were coming. They were coming right to you. You didn't have to hunt them down. And I love Columbo too. Stu.
Fair play, fair play. Did you ever work any of the big sporting events?
Yes. Yankee Stadium during the playoffs and World Series. Shea Stadium when they played the Yankees in the 2000 World Series. I was on the field a lot of times because in the 70s and 80s, when and somebody won, the fields would run on the field and tear up the field and take the bases home as souvenirs. So what they have now is the cops come running out onto the field immediately after every playoff game. So that doesn't happen. Worked the U.S. Open several times, the tennis matches. Well, there's no football games in New York City anymore, unfortunately. Yeah, a lot of baseball games, hockey a couple of times.
Fair play, fair play. Well, before we wrap it up.
Oh, wait, I got a good one. We I think it was the 94 when the Rangers won the Stanley Cup. I've worked a bunch of ticker tape parades where you're walking alongside the cars and some of those fucking idiots forget to shred things and they throw whole phone books out the window. A phone book almost took my friggin' head and went whap. You know, you got the confetti and someone tossed a phone book out an office window. It probably intentionally. That thing would have hit me. I would have had more neck problems than I have now. So be careful in ticker tape parades. People throw batteries in phone books.
Gee whiz.
Health and safety. Thanks, Vic.
Yeah. You always get one piece of advice from this podcast. Yeah. So just on the NFL then, just quickly, on the old American football, your Raiders didn't make the playoffs there. My Steelers did for what it was worth. What was your tip for the Super Bowl?
I think it's going to be Baltimore and San Francisco. And just my opinion, I don't think the Chiefs have that. They gave Mahomes that big contract. They don't have a true number one wide receiver. I think if you can double team Rashee Rice, their wide receiver, because Kelce, you don't really need to double team anymore. He doesn't have that wiggle that he used to. He's old and he's thinking about going home to Taylor Swift. I think the 49ers are going to. 49ers and Baltimore.
Who wins it?
I think probably Baltimore.
Yeah, that's my money. My money's on the Ravens and Lamar Jackson to be MVP. That'd be
Let me ask you something. What do you think the Steelers are going to do quarterback-wise?
Well, according to Tomlin, we're starting with Pickett next year. Pickett's the guy. I'm not convinced. I think Mason Rudolph, you know, for all his knockers over the years, He had the team galvanized. Yeah, he's not the guy, but he had the team better galvanized. The thing I don't like about Pickett is, you know, I know people joke about his small hands and stuff. I don't think that's the problem. The issue with him is you look at him once that pocket gets breached, he looks afraid to get hit. And what we're used to in Pittsburgh is that Big Ben guy is like, you can hit him, but you're going to bounce straight off him. And he's going to run over the top of you. And I think we need somebody like that. I don't think Rudolph's a guy either, but I would put Rudolph ahead of Pickett. I'd put Rudolph ahead of Pickett. And I never thought those words would come out of my mouth after what I'd seen
Rudolph do. I don't think Pickett has a good enough arm. He's got an average arm. He can't push it down the field. You know why Tomlin is so smart in addition to being a really good coach? Because Tomlin's not the GM. And I don't think Tomlin has a lot of say with the personnel moves because the Steelers have been drafting the same way since the 70s.
100%, yeah.
They're just masters of getting good wide receivers and defensive players. They just have a knack for it. They have a formula for pass rushers. They're awesome at doing it. You notice Tomlin never rocks the boat with whoever the quarterback is. So they drafted Pickett as their number one pick. He's going with him because at the end of the day, you drafted him. If he starts playing this game of you know, rotisserie chicken or pushing the Rooney's hand to get another quarterback and it doesn't work out, well, you wanted this guy. He's going what they gave him. Yeah. I think that's a genius move, in my opinion, the way he's able to work management.
Yeah, I do wonder if we'll maybe bring in somebody from another team who is either surplus to requirements, someone with a little bit of experience, someone that Pickett can learn off. Because, you know, I gather between Roethlisberger and Rudolph that there wasn't that bond. There wasn't, you know, I don't think he was willing, you know, I don't think Rudolph was willing to learn from Big Ben, and Big Ben wasn't too keen to teach him or what have you.
I don't think Ben was a teacher because if you remember before Rudolph, you had Landry.
Yeah,
Landry Jones, really good in college. Yeah. And I think Big Ben is kind of like a Tom Brady. I'm taking all those reps, kid, and you know, learn what you can, but I don't have time for you. I don't know that to be true, but it just kind of seems like a pattern over there.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me. I do think we need to I tell you one guy, and He's much maligned, and yes, he does have the odd bad game, and yes, he does get hit a lot, but he ain't afraid to get hit, and he's physical. I think Baker Mayfield would be a good fit for the Steelers. I'd love to see him there. I think he's had probably a too good a season with the Bucs for them to let him go. I think they'll be tying him down on a contract.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'm not a Mayfield guy. He's tough. He's gritty, but he doesn't have the size. You know, the only small quarterback that really excelled at his size is Drew Brees. But that's because Brees had like a super microprocessor. You know, he could boom, 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 and the ball is out. You know what I mean? Mayfield hesitates that extra second, and that's why he's always getting the crap knocked out of him.
Yeah, I just would like to see him. I would just want to know what the guy can do in the black and yellow. It'd be interesting to see. It would. I don't think we'll ever see it, though, if I'm honest.
I think if you get a good quarterback, you know who's going to – here's another problem with the Steelers, and it happens every couple of years. They draft these really good players, and it's ego. You guys would have been a powerhouse. You guys would have had three rings already had Antonio Brown not lost his mind, Le'Veon Bell didn't decide to ruin his career and sit out for a year, and Martavius Bryant didn't go off the rails. You had three guys and three Pro Bowlers on offense. So when people say, well, Tomlin's, you know, he's an average, because he's not. If he would have had that talent, you guys would have had three rings already.
100%. Yeah, it's one of the most frustrating things. And I've got a Le'Veon Bell Steelers jersey. I love that guy. I thought he was a talent. Just that pause before you run, you know what I mean? Literally, he would start go. He knew, yeah. He was methodical. Amazing. He's probably, you know, he was high as a kite at the time he was doing
I think he spent a lot of time with LeGarrette Blount, and that's one of the reasons you guys cut LeGarrette Blount.
Yeah, the old Cheech and Chong move that they pulled.
Because he was smoking a blunt.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, Dave loves his NFL, don't you, pal?
He doesn't like the NFL?
No. Sorry, was that mute? It was also mute for you guys. Have you finished?
Yeah.
you just talk random for 5 minutes. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, Dave's not an NFL fan. But who knows, we'll do an NFL episode. Maybe we'll do a Super Bowl watch party. We're definitely going to do a politics watch party at some point when that general election happens in the UK. But Vic, we're at the hour mark. Would you, or a little beyond it, would you like to say a goodbye to our listeners?
I would. Adam, David, Stu, Gaz, they couldn't make it. Thank you so much for having me on your show. If you want to hear more of my NYPD stories, just go to Amazon book page, type in my name, Vic Ferrari Like the Car, where all my books will come up. They're $10 paperback, $2.99 ebook download, including NYPD, Laughing in the Line of Duty. And if you like podcasts, check out my podcast. It's the same name as the book, NYPD Through the Looking Glass, stories from inside America's largest police department. And I bring on guests and espouse about NYPD stories.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what I will do, and I do on every time we have you on, we do a little blog on our website about it. It's literally a micro bob, and it's more about really what beer we drink and that kind of stuff. But we do a little bit of a blurb, and I always add in a link to your Amazon site so you can buy the book. But I'll also add a link to your podcast as well so that people can listen to that, because I listen to it, and I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, what would you say? I'm like number one in Bora Bora. Or
no, you are. You're in the top 5% of podcasts globally. So that's pretty, you know, just to keep you updated on the Cambodian podcast, Charles.
That's in Cambodia. All right. Yeah, that was Bora Bora.
Number 182. Dave?
Yeah, it's great to have you on again, Vic. And you said earlier you were learning all the time and your PR and all that. And I love the way that you faked the blackout 2 weeks ago, so you got half an episode there and a whole episode now. It's 50% extra. Nice work, Vic. Love it. So good on you. No, it's seriously, it's great to have you on. Your stories are always funny. You're a great guy. Brilliant.
Always, Dave, you always have to have them wanting more.
Exactly. And don't you worry, folks. It won't be the last time that we have Vic Ferrari on the podcast. I can promise you that. So that just leaves it for me to wrap it up. Next week, we're back with something entirely different. I've got to ask Dave about it because Dave's organized this one. So he's organized the guest. I know nothing about it. So I need to do a little bit of research for that one. But we will say goodbye. We'll say thank you to Vic. I would encourage you to head to Amazon and pick up some of his books. Like you say, he calls them $10 stocking stuffers over here in the UK. It's only $7.99. And obviously, check out our website so you can pick up the links to his podcast as well. So we will say thank you and good night.